From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jack Kerouac based the hero of his 1958 novel Dharma Bums on the poet Gary Snyder. Now Snyder is best known for his poems and essays about nature. On today's Fresh Air, Gary Snyder on poetry, Buddhism, and the wild. Also, cartoonist Drew and Josh Allen Friedman on their bizarre gallery of washed-up actors, nightmare teachers, and grown men who sell comic books. Rock critic Ken Tucker tells us how he tried to come to the rescue of Bob Dylan, but just couldn't. He reviews Dylan's new record, Under the Red Sky. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Martin Scorsese's new film, Goodfellas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Olympic Council of Asia voted overwhelmingly today to bar Iraq from the Asian Games being held in Beijing. The decision came only 2 days before the opening ceremonies for China's first major international sporting event. Sarah Lubman reports from Beijing.
Delegates emerging from the Olympic Council of Asia meeting said the vote was 27-3 to expel Iraq from the Asian Games. The expulsion was proposed last week by the Council's Executive Committee to punish Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait. Some Arab nations had threatened to boycott the competition if Iraq participated. The expulsion was the first major incident to mar the 11th Asian Games. China had hoped to use the event to promote Asian unity and to regain international prestige lost in the wake of last year's crackdown on democracy protesters. For National Public Radio, this is Sarah Lubman in Beijing.
Iraq's Revolution Command Council issued a hardline statement today, saying there was no chance of retreat from Iraq's position in the Persian Gulf crisis. The council issued the statement after a late meeting led by Saddam Hussein. The statement claimed the struggle was being waged for the liberation of Jerusalem and other holy shrines. It was the toughest Iraqi declaration so far, and different from prior comments in that it made no mention of peace. It also accused Iraq's enemies of denying food to the Iraqi people and of putting the people of Iraq in prison with a proposed air embargo. Yemeni workers in Saudi Arabia are feeling the brunt of Saudi Arabia's displeasure with their government's policy in the Gulf crisis. The Saudis have changed work regulations that will result in the expulsion of thousands of Yemenis from the country. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
There are about 1 million Yemenis working in Saudi Arabia, sending home more than $800 million a year. Unlike other workers, Yemenis need no Saudi sponsors to work in the kingdom. They can open their own businesses without a Saudi partner. The government has canceled those special privileges. It's likely that many Yemenis will have to go home. Yemen has sided with Iraq in the Gulf crisis. The day after the Iraqi invasion, a squadron of Iraqi planes landed in Yemen, Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor. But not all Yemenis agree with their government's policy. Many of Yemen's tribes in the oil-rich northern province have sent messages of support to the Saudi king. The Saudi government is sending a message back. In Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street, apparently in response to indications that the Federal Reserve isn't planning to lower interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 39 points to close at 2,518.32. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-1 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 145 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Allen Ginsberg has called my guest, poet Gary Snyder, an American literary cultural hero, ripened as wilderness philosopher activist, integrating ecological planet karma with Native American poetry's indigenous household view. Snyder became something of a countercultural hero in the 50s when Jack Kerouac used him as the model for the main character in his novel Dharma Bums. Snyder left San Francisco's beat poetry scene in 1956. His interest in Asian thought led him to the East, where he spent the next 12 years studying Buddhism in Japan and visiting temples in India. When he returned to the States, he settled in Northern California, became active in environmental issues, and continued to write poetry and essays about the natural world. His book Turtle Island won a Pulitzer Prize. His essays from the past 15 years are collected in the new book The Practice of the Wild. It's published by North Point Press, which also just brought out a new edition of his collection Rip Rap and Cold Mountain Poems. Later in the fall, Sierra Club Books will publish a collection of essays about Snyder, written by friends and family. Snyder lives on the San Juan Ridge in Northern California. In his essays, he writes a lot about having a sense of place. I asked when a sense of place first became important to him.
Growing up as I did in the forested areas north of Seattle, I bonded, as you might say, to my original place very strongly, being out in it a lot and working on the farm around it a lot. And learning my way through the forest and through the swamps. I think that this is a very natural and normal thing to do. And all I've done, really, is expand the territory of the place that I really feel I can be at home in. And I've moved the center from Puget Sound down here to the Sierra Nevada of California. But my larger sense of place, and I could tell you how I define that, covers the West Coast from Big Sur to Fairbanks, Alaska.
How close to the wilderness do you live?
Depends on what you mean by wilderness, but we have black bear, mountain lions, lots of deer, fox wandering right through our yard.
You asked me what I mean by wilderness, so let me ask you what you mean by the wild in the title of your book, The Practice of the Wild.
By the wild, I mean something a little different from wilderness. I mean, by the wild, I mean the essential processes of unmediated nature. And as processes, they're found on every level, from the microscopic to the cosmic, and consequently, the wild is permeates cities, permeates factories, and is really what our own bodies are, wild organisms. Wilderness would be those territories where the processes of the wild are maximized, but the wild is nothing endangered at all.
There's a reading I'd like you to do from The Practice of the Wild, your new collection of essays. This begins with a reference to Thoreau.
I'll read it for you. Thoreau says, "Give me a wildness no civilization can endure." That's clearly not difficult to find. It is harder to imagine a civilization that wildness can endure, yet this is just what we must try to do. Wildness is not just the preservation of the world, as Thoreau says, it is the world. Civilizations east and west have long been on a collision course with wild nature, and now the developed nations in particular have the witless power to destroy not only individual creatures, but whole species, whole processes of the earth. We need a civilization that can live fully and creatively together with wildness. We must start growing it right here in the new world.
In addition to your new book coming out, The Practice of the Wild, there's a book about you that's coming out soon. It's called Gary Snyder, Dimensions of a Life, and it's a lot of essays and short memoirs about you. And one person in it, Michael Mahar, says that your mother, when you were growing up with this guy, that your mother had canceled a weekend camping trip because you didn't get an A on a Latin quiz, so you had to stay home and do homework. and he says that the other kids' parents didn't stress school because the other kids weren't expected to grow up and go into jobs where formal education was required. Did your mother stress school a lot, and what were her expectations for what you were going to grow up and do?
My mother stressed learning. And she stressed literacy and reading a lot, and never said a word about careers or about expectations of success. She had a much broader humanistic sort of open position than some narrowly defined notion of what you should become or do, although at the time I didn't realize it.
Michael Mahar also said that you were so poor that you used to bring your own tea bags to coffee shops because you couldn't afford the price of the tea.
We all did that in college.
Uh-huh. Were you poor?
Oh, yeah. I grew up in the Depression and was doing a lot of work and supporting myself a lot from about 15 on.
What did your parents do?
My father was from an old Pacific Northwest working family. who worked for the U.S. government during World War II after being unemployed for a number of years of the Depression, and in later years stayed on and off working for the government and doing a lot of carpentry and cabinet building. My mother was wanted to be a writer and got in a couple of years at the University of Washington as a young woman and did some nice writing of poetry and short stories, but then the Depression cut all that short. And she found herself living out on a stump farm in the woods and was rather frustrated by that.
When you were in your 20s, I guess, and spending some time logging, was that mostly to be in nature or mostly to make a living?
Oh, that was a good way to make some money. And it was in line with the skills I had because where I grew up, we handled those tools a lot. Our neighbors, my uncles, were all working either in the woods or at sea. And so with those skills, it wasn't difficult for me to pick up employment. And I switched back and forth between working as a seasonal laborer for the U.S. Forest Service sometimes or working in logging camps.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I think the big environmental issue this past summer out your way was deforestation, the cutting of original growth like the old redwoods.
Mm-hmm.
As a former logger yourself, where were you on that issue?
Well, I'm also very active in environmental issues, and I've been working on forestry issues that's been one of my main focuses last 10 years. Of course, I believe that it's quite possible to have a sustainable logging industry that could be carried on for thousands of years, but that requires much more careful management policies than the U.S. government is calling for on public land today, and infinitely more careful practices than is being carried on private land.
Gary Snyder is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays called The Practice of the Wild. You've written, I grew up with the poetry of 20th century coolness, its hard edges and resilient elitism. When it came to writing out of my own experience, most of modernism didn't fit. Why didn't modernism fit your experience?
It's a little hard to put an answer to that, except to say modernism is resolutely urban and cosmopolitan and had its spiritual centers in Paris, London, and New York. Nature was considered second class and marginal by the mentality of modernism. Whereas for someone like myself, out at the far edge of the New World, in an area that had only been settled for 40 years and had been a vast forest wilderness for all previous millennia, the experiences are not the same. The things, looking at mountain landscapes, working with wildlife, and also with the physical labor of tools and logging exploitation, the human problems of both Indians and white people around Puget Sound, there's no place in that in the poetry of T.S. Eliot or Wallace Stevens.
And you found what you were looking for more in Chinese and Japanese poems?
It gave me a push in a new direction. It's not as though that was a whole new model to follow by any means, but a Chinese civilization, for example, Chinese culture, opened up an angle to me of the possibility of a high civilization with all of that refinement and sophistication that we expect from a civilization that had a much less exploitative attitude toward the natural world. Now, to be honest, as it turns out in practice, by the time the 20th century rolls around, China and Japan are just as bad as anybody else.
You reprint some of your poems in The Practice of the Wild, and I'm going to ask you to read one of those poems for us, any one of your choosing.
This comes out of the world of the experience of a young white guy logging together with elder Indian working men loggers, Native American Indian loggers, with some of the cultural complexities of that. Ray Wells, a big Nisqually, and I each set a choker on the butt logs of two big larch in a thorn apple thicket and a swamp. Waiting for the cat to come back, he said, "Yesterday We gilded some ponies. My father-in-law cut the skin on the balls. He's a Wasco and don't speak English. He grabs a handful of tubes and somehow cuts the right ones. The ball jumps out. The horse screams, but he's all tied up. The caterpillar clanked back down. In the shadow of that racket, diesel and iron tread, I thought of Ray Wells' teepee out on the sage flats, the gelded ponies healing and grazing in the dead white heat.
Were you ever considered odd for liking poetry when you were young?
Not in my immediate family. Actually, I must confess, no. I was never given any trouble for it anywhere. Not in logging camps and not working on ships.
But you expected to be, maybe? Did you ever, like, hide it initially from people?
I'll tell you what I hid when I was working on ships or in logging camps. I hid my educated vocabulary and educated tone of voice. I talked like a working man. That covers everything.
Was it natural for you to talk that way? I mean, which was your first tongue? Which was your native tongue? Talking like a working man or talking like an educated man?
I grew up with both, I would say about equally.
So you're bilingual.
Bilingual, right. Bidialectical.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is writer Gary Snyder, and he has a new collection of essays, and it's called The Practice of the Wild. This is Fresh Air. Essayist, naturalist, and environmentalist Gary Snyder is my guest. You moved to the Bay Area in, what, I think it was 1952?
52, yeah.
And it was in the Bay Area that you met Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. I'm wondering if you felt that you found kindred spirits when you met them.
Oh, indeed I did. There weren't many poets around that were working in the kind of idiom that I was trying for. And it was a great pleasure to run onto Allen and then to Jack Kerouac. Prior to that, my only other poetic comrades were Philip Whalen and Lew Welch.
Now, Ginsberg and Kerouac were both urban.
And but widely traveled and widely worked. Both of them had been to sea, both of them had been to Mexico.
So that wasn't a gap for you, the difference between your...
We worked it out. I mean, I took them hiking, and they taught me some city smarts.
Like what?
Well, Jack taught me how to sit on the backside of Skid Row and drink Tokay out of a bottle in a brown paper sack.
A useful skill, huh?
Yeah. And how not to get noticed doing that.
Right. Well, that is very useful.
Yeah.
Now you were the main character in Kerouac's book Dharma Bums was based on you.
Yeah, so I'm told.
And well, I want to read you a short description here. He wore a little goatee, strangely Oriental-looking, with his somewhat slanted green eyes. But he didn't look like a bohemian at all, and was far from being a bohemian, a hanger-oner around the arts. He was wiry, suntanned, vigorous, open, all howdies and glad talk, and even yelling hello to bums on the street. And when asked a question, answered right off the bat from the top or bottom of his mind, I don't know which, and always in a sprightly, sparkling way. Sound like you?
Maybe not quite that cheery. Otherwise, okay.
there's a part in Dharma Bums where the character who I assume to be the Kerouac character, where the character based on you, Jeffrey Ryder, is talking to the character I assume to be based on Kerouac, and is talking to him about drinking too much and warning him about how it's really going to hurt him in the long run. Did you have conversations like that with Kerouac?
Oh, indeed I did. And it's part of the paradox of Jack's life that he could hear that conversation in real life, report it quite accurately in a novel, and then go ahead and keep drinking.
Right.
Yeah.
You left San Francisco after a few years and left the poetry scene there. Why did you move on?
Well, I had moved out. I was in graduate school at Indiana University after I left Reed College for a year in linguistics. And I came out to the Bay Area to study Chinese and Japanese at Berkeley to prepare myself to go to the Far East. I had decided that I wanted to study Zen Buddhism. And so when the opportunities all came together, I set sail, literally right out of San Francisco, to go to Japan and study. And I left all that poetry scene behind.
Did you ever think of yourself as spending the rest of your life in a monastery? Was that a consideration at all, or was there something else that you wanted to get out of the experience?
A Zen monastery is not a monastery in the Catholic sense, a place where you commit yourself to live for a lifetime. A Zen monastery could be more reasonably described as a sort of seminary. It's a training school, and when you finished your training, you move on. Moving on means you re-enter the world and you do what you can do. It was never my intention to stay there for a lifetime, but to come back to this continent and see what I could do.
You write that at the monastery where you were, novices were told to leave their past behind and to become unexceptional in all ways, except for the intention to comprehend their Zen koans. Mm-hmm. Were you enthusiastic about the idea of trying to be unexceptional? I mean, let's face it, as a writer, I think one always tries to be exceptional, to find the right word, to have a poem be exceptionally good.
It was a marvelous training for me to be put somewhere where I was not to be exceptional. I recommend it highly. It's a wonderfully humbling experience. And as a writer, in a certain sense, as a poet, in a certain sense, I would not want to be exceptional. I would like my idea of a truly accomplished poetry is one that does not call attention to itself, which is part of the Far Eastern aesthetic, actually.
Was writing poetry compatible with Zen studies? Did your Zen teacher approve of your writing poems?
He tormented me. he said, I could write poetry if it came from my true self. But who knows what your true self is? And then he twitted me by saying, poets have to play a lot. And so I thought, maybe I should quit writing poetry, because I certainly wasn't playing. Later one time, I said to him, Roshi, so Zen is serious, but poetry's not serious. And he said, no, poetry is serious. Zen is not serious. He had a lot of fun with me.
So when you left, was it because you felt ready to leave or because your teacher felt you were ready to leave?
Well, my teacher died.
Oh.
After he died, I spent a couple of years living in Kyoto and studying other schools of Buddhism and visiting other temples and other monasteries and reflecting on what I had done with my teacher for those 6 years. I had then to make the choice between starting again over there with another teacher or coming back to this country. And just at that time, the beginning of the new round of ecological awareness was trembling on the horizon, and I could feel it. And the truth is, I came back in part because I wanted to be part of that.
So much of Zen teaching is about paradox, and you give a great example in your new book that your teacher would lecture you on the phrase, the perfect way is without difficulty, strive hard. I'm sure in environmentalism that there's a lot of paradoxes that you have to deal with now. I'm wondering what some of those might be. I mean, I'm wondering if you see paradox and accept it where others might not accept it.
Well, there are several paradoxes. Yeah, I hadn't thought about this before, but now that you bring it up, there are several that I've been aware of over the last few years. And one is that dedicated environmental activists, people who are really concerned to try to stop the loss of biological diversity, the loss of habitat, and the loss of good air and good water on the planet, who are lovers of wildness, are, if they are going to be effective, they are forced to understand the details of bureaucracy, economics, politics, and be willing to spend long hours working on computers, long hours on the phone, or even go and live in Washington, D.C. Now, there's a paradox for you.
If I'm not mistaken, during the McCarthy era, when you were working for the National Forest Service for a while, you... What, you were blacklisted or something? You had to leave?
Because I was fired.
You were fired?
I was fired on orders from Washington, D.C.
What exactly had you done or thought politically that that got you fired?
I think it was probably because I got my Siemens papers when I was 18 in New York City through the intercession of some officials in the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which was considered at that time a Communist Party-dominated union. And because friends of mine arranged that for me, they assumed that I was Communist Party or very close to Communist Party. I certainly had many friends who were in the far left there, but my own position had always been that of a cantankerous anarchist, in fact. Nonetheless, you know, that stuck on my record for some years.
Do you think of yourself as a cantankerous anarchist now?
Oh, sure.
And what does that mean?
That means I'm very dubious about the virtue or the legitimacy of the national state as an institution. And I do believe that human beings are and can be self-governing in smaller social units. And that for the most part, what we call a national government is a giant protection racket, just like the mafia runs.
What kind of relationship do you have with the people who live near you politically and socially? I don't mean, you know, like going over for a cup of tea or something, but in terms of the environmental interests that you care most about and the things that you need to do to preserve the wildness around you.
We all work together. It is an error to think that people who live in rural areas have an easy time of it and can lay back and groove with nature and that there's no politics. The politics of public lands, of resource extraction, mining in this case, water politics, and the pressures of rapid real estate development and growth are all around us. And we have meetings two or three nights a week.
Do anarchists like yourself like going to meetings three times a week?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I find no contradiction in that.
You don't?
I mean, anarchism simply means self-governing. And self-governing means you got to get out there and learn how to do it.
Your new book is a collection of essays that you've been working on for a long time. Are you still writing poems?
Oh, yeah, I've been writing a lot of poems over the last few years.
Any that are short and that you remember, because I know you probably don't have any recent ones with you, but is there any short poem you'd like to leave us with?
I'd like to leave you with this, which is a little turn on forests and the idea of ecological climax. A virgin forest is ancient, many-breasted, stable at climax.
Gary Snyder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gary Snyder. His new collection of essays is The Practice of the Wild, and there's a new edition of his book Rip Rap and Cold Mountain Poems. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Jeff Goldblum. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the creators of such comics as I, Joey Heatherton, Hollywood's Wildest Love Duos, and The Entertainment Freak. A talk with Drew and Josh Allen Friedman about their new collection, Warts and All. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new album, Under the Red Sky, a record he would have liked to have been impressed by. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese's new film about a mob family. It stars Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Ray Liotta. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In South Africa, the African National Congress has announced that its deputy president, Nelson Mandela, is willing to meet with Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the leader of the rival Inkatha Freedom Party, in an effort to seek ways to end the violence between their followers. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The National Executive Committee of the ANC ended a three-day special session with the announcement that it will call a meeting of all the leaders of black homelands to get to the root causes of the violence that has cost more than 750 lives. That means that if Buthelezi accepts, he and Mandela will meet for the first time since Mandela was released from prison. Until now, Mandela has not been willing to meet Buthelezi. Buthelezi has called repeatedly for a meeting with Mandela to help end the violence, but he obviously intended that the two men would meet as leaders of important constituencies and not with a large group of other leaders of lesser importance. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
And the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. says that Washington needs to pay the $500 million it owes the U.N. in dues. Thomas Pickering told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that he is disturbed by the fact that the U.S. is now the largest debtor to the international organization, and what the U.N. has been doing in the Persian Gulf crisis underlines the need to pay what the U.S. owes. Poland's parliament has started discussing a timetable for new presidential and parliamentary elections, which will complete the dismantling of the former communist regime. Jan Repa reports from Warsaw.
The Polish parliament has a formidable workload. It must decide when the new presidential and parliamentary elections should take place, whether they should be held together or separately, what sort of electoral system to adopt, and when Poland ought to get a brand new constitution matching its new status as a fully sovereign democracy. The debate is set to continue for several days. However, it looks as if Poland will have a new popularly elected president by December and a new freely elected parliament by early spring. Most pro-government MPs want to first pass the post-voting system, which would keep the smaller parties out of parliament, giving it, they say, greater stability. The ex-communists favor proportional representation, which could save them from electoral annihilation. For National Public Radio, I'm Jan Repa in Warsaw.
East and West Germany have ratified a final treaty before unification October 3rd. The two Germanys ratified an agreement to dissolve East Germany in 13 days and join it with the West. The treaty was approved by the West German Parliament by a vote of 442-47, and by the East German Parliament by a vote of 299-80. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 39 points to close at 2,518.32. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, lifestyles of the obscure and once famous documented in wicked cartoons. Right now, rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Bob Dylan's new album, Under the Red Sky.
I knew I was really interested in hearing Under the Red Sky when Rolling Stone magazine gave it only 2 stars. Dylan has always been one of publisher Jan Wenner's pampered pets, and rave reviews of even Dylan's lamest work are routinely ordered up. So for this one to receive a mere 2 stars seemed odd and exceptional. I began to think that even though the album was also being panned elsewhere as well, maybe the music was being misinterpreted. Here was my chance, I thought. I could offer a brilliant and original analysis of a Dylan album that was being cruelly misunderstood. Upon hearing my review, rock critic colleagues would bow down at my singular independence and insight. Dylan, out of sheer gratefulness, would send me an admiring letter, or at the very least ask me to produce his next album. Then I made the mistake of actually listening to Under the Red Sky, which sort of ruined my idea.
Handy dandy controversies.
That's Handy Dandy, a song in which Dylan deliberately trashes his own work, in this case by echoing the melody of Like a Rolling Stone, even having Al Kooper play keyboards on it, but filling that melody with a song of almost amazing ridiculousness. Sometimes, of course, Dylan intends his ridiculousness to have a purpose, as it does on a tune called Wiggle Wiggle. Reviewers are singling this one out as really dumb, but they've missed the point. It's Dylan's version of a smutty blues song, his updating of old-fashioned, euphemistically obscene songs like Hank Ballard's Work With Me Annie. Bob Dylan has never released an album with so little at stake than Under the Red Sky, unless the idea was to erase what little goodwill we might still feel toward him. Of course, I realize that someone says this every time he's put out a record. Proof of this is a 1972 book about Dylan, edited by Craig McGregor, that's just been reissued. Entitled Bob Dylan, The Early Years, the book reminds us that Dylan has spent his entire career deflecting charges like mine. You can read a 1966 piece in this book by Studs Terkel, who, writing about Dylan's shocking switch from folk to rock, says that Dylan has become, quote, a showbiz wind-up doll. The alchemy of commerce has transmuted him into a golden boy toy. By the way, can you believe it? It was apparently Studs Terkel who came up with Madonna's belt buckle self-definition, boy toy. Anyway, Under the Red Sky was produced by Don and David Was, who have treated the idea of working with a legend in much the same way they did when they employed Mel Torme and Frank Sinatra Jr. on their own Was Not Was records, as a complete joke.
There was a little boy, and there was a little girl, and they lived in an alley under the red sky. There was a little boy, and there was a little girl, and they lived in an alley under the red sky.
Last time out on the 1989 album Oh Mercy, Dylan sang, "We live in a political world," and even if he didn't work out the politics in any detail, he did suggest that he was pondering the subtleties. On this album, he's decided that crankiness is the better part of valor, and inveighs against greed, the banality of TV, and the perfidy of women.
God knows you ain't pretty. God knows it's true. God knows there ain't anybody ever gonna take the place of you. God knows it's a struggle. God knows it's a crime. God knows there's gonna be no more water but fire next time.
Well, God knows I even liked him better when he was a born-again Christian. At least his smugness had some honest malice in it then. The way Dylan is going, I predict that he'll announce a tour next spring in which he'll perform all Elvis Presley songs and employ two live crew as the Jordanaires to sing backup, the Me So Horny Before the Flood tour. I'd go to see it, too.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Unbelievable, it will get this far. It's undeniable why they have you to think. It's indescribable, they can drive you to dream. That's it.
unbelievable. You can get this rich this quick.
This is Fresh Air. It's unusual to find a glossary in the back of a book of comics, but since cartoonist Drew and Josh Allen Friedman are fascinated by some pretty obscure has-beens of popular culture, you need a glossary to figure out who they've targeted in their new book, Warts and All. People like Tor Johnson, the giant Swedish ex-wrestler who achieved movie infamy in cheap horror films. Drew draws, and Josh's brother writes the stories for most of the cartoons. Drew's cartoon style can best be described as exaggerated realism. And Josh's stories are caustic and witty. Drew's work also appears in Spy Magazine and Raw. He also designed a new, purposely disgusting candy called the Barfo Family. In their new book, there's one strip called I, Joey Heatherton. The story is written by Josh.
I've always had a fascination with certain types of showbiz characters like Frank Sinatra Jr. or Wayne Newton or Joey Heatherton, and For years, I kept the file on every clipping I saw about Joey. I tried to interview her once or twice, and she would turn me down. And about 4 years ago, all of a sudden, she started making Post headlines when she just disappeared with two suitcases. She went on the run, and she was in all sorts of trouble. And they had a Dear Joey column on the cover of the New York Post for a week. And that just was the last straw. I had to turn that into a comic strip, and I researched her entire life. And in a sense, some of the characters we do, it's almost like we get to make a movie using anybody we want without being in the movie business. We do it through a cartoon strip instead because nobody wants to do cartoons and everyone in the world wants to do movies. So we could, if we wanted to star Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet in our own movie, we would just do a comic strip about them.
Now, in addition to paying tribute to B-movie actors, you also make up characters like Marnon Charnin, who gets a job at age 30 as a carpet store salesman because his bar mitzvah funds have been depleted, and he channels his sexual frustrations into becoming the greatest carpet salesman in America. Josh, was this based on someone you know?
This Marnon is an original character, although in actuality he also is an actual person, and it's based on every second of that is an actual experience with Marnon, who's just a guy we kind of knew when we grew up, a friend of ours.
Now he's buying the original artwork off us.
Oh, really? And saying, hey, this is about me?
Yeah. Well, he's come into some money lately, and now all of a sudden he's buying the original art and hanging up in his home. And
he went from total poverty into a little landfall. Now he's bought some of his comic strips. And again, if you can do a comic strip about Marnon, you could probably do it about anybody in the world.
Are you suggesting that's how uninteresting he is?
Well, Marnon is basically a guy who spends a lot of time watching TV and buying comic books, and you know, but we still feel we should pay tribute to the man for his achievements.
How did you start working together?
I think the way it started, Drew for many years had been drawing on his desk in school, drawing his teachers naked, getting into trouble with drawing. He drew very ugly people for many years, and teachers were recommending he be sent to, you know, be looked at by a shrink or something. But my response to that was to try and channel it into something. So in the late 1970s, I just wrote a script. I said, Drew, you just got to do something with this instead of just, you know, it was almost like a guerrilla artwork that he was doing. So the first strip we did was called The Andy Griffith Show. And it was just a means to get Drew to do something with his art.
So Drew, when Josh started drawing stories for you to illustrate, you know, to draw comics around, was that a revelation for you that you could channel this into something?
Yeah, at that point in the late 70s, I was sort of kind of, I wasn't centered on any particular thing, and all of a sudden it hit us, why don't we just start doing some comic strips our way? And we had several ideas. One of them was, what if Fred Mertz became pregnant? We didn't go in that direction, but we did
The actual thing that instigated, we imagined, what if Fred Mertz put a Q-tip in his ear and cleaned his ear, right? And that triggered a whole comic strip.
That launched everything. And we turned him into a – and he was the landlord of that building they used in I Love Lucy, so we sort of turned him into a slum lord and
– arsonist and which but, was appropriate at the time to do it.
Yeah. This was the early period.
Drew, your drawings are really incredible. They're like super real drawings.
Right.
And every detail on the face is there and almost enlarged. I mean, there's more, warts and all.
Warts and all.
But there's more details in your drawings than there are in most photographs. Photographs seem airbrushed by comparison to your drawings.
Mm-hmm.
Do you work off of photographs? Do you copy photographs?
I do.
When it's based on real people?
I do use a lot of photo reference when it's based on real people. And that's I do it for several reasons. One, I want it to disturb people and for people to really think that this possibly could have happened, or this actually could have taken place. I want it really to have a photorealistic look to it, a documentary type look that just kind of is disturbing to people. But when I use photos, I try to exaggerate just ever so slightly because I'm not a caricaturist and I want to keep it as realistic as possible, but just make it, just a little bit weirder and hopefully a little disturbing. And that's the effect that we get.
Drew, you have an incredible eye for faces. And a lot of the faces that seem to interest you in the original drawings are faces that are really grotesque.
Mm.
Like, for instance, there's a strip in Warts and All called Comic Shop Clerks of America, Grown Men Who Sell Comic Books. And they're all like monstrous looking. They all have warts on their faces. They're missing teeth. They're balding in unusual patterns. They have saliva strings between their teeth when they open their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why you're so absorbed in really ugly faces.
Oh, aside from the comic strips, which I want to be interesting and pretty. I suppose. I mean, it's kind of attractive artwork. I also find attractiveness in, like you say, disgusting, ugly, horrible-looking faces. There's just nothing that pleasures me more than being hunched over my desk, stippling in warts and
double chins.
Double chins. I think I'm also the master of liver spots.
Yes.
My editor at Spy Magazine brings that up every time I bring in a new drawing. He says, "Drew, you better tone down those liver spots." So. It's just I just really enjoy getting into the crevices of a horrible looking face. And to me, it's not the faces aren't horrible. I find beauty in a certain kind of ugliness. And there's nothing more attractive to me than
an elevator man.
Horrible
a New
looking.
York doorman or elevator man is a real beauty to us as a study.
Let's get to one of the more personal strips, the Nightmare Gallery of Mentally Disturbed Teachers. Are the people in this strip really taken from teachers that you had?
Yeah, those are all actual teachers of mine, and Drew was 2 years behind me in school, so he had some of them too, luckily, because we had no pictures for references. We're talking 20 years back where we went to school. I always felt that the teachers at my school, at my public school in Long Island, were 9 out of 10 of them were officially disturbed people. There's no question that they had a very bad influence on kids. They were very destructive to me. And
tell us about one of the real destructive ones. One of the ones that was really destructive to you.
Well, my fifth grade teacher was a middle-aged man who used to scream at the class, and he hated most of the kids. He hated his job. He was a chain smoker. And he drank 20 cups of coffee a day. He had dandruff. And I just remember standing before his desk totally confused with the math that we were learning and never taking the time to be patient and explain it to me, just yelling at me and smacking a ruler to go back and do it again. And it was a miserable year. So he just gets one panel in our strip. And Drew, from memory from 20 years ago, actually drew these teachers the way they looked.
Your father is the humorist Bruce J. Friedman, and he wrote the book The Lonely Guy. He wrote the screenplay for Splash. Did you grow up with a lot of humorists, and did humor seem like a feasible way to actually make a living?
Yeah, it did to us. It was just like the insurance business to us. And secondly, humor never seemed funny to us, and anything that we do that might go under the category of humor, we don't see as really funny. We're not like...
Yeah.
We don't think of ourselves as being funny, or we don't think of the strips as funny.
When I see this book in the humor section in bookstores, I'm just kind of confused about it.
Why?
Well, to me, the humor section of a bookstore is always the least funniest section. I derive humor from, I don't derive humor from Mad Magazine or National Lampoon. To me, the Christian Science Monitor is a funny publication, and there's nothing funnier than People Magazine. And
Reader's Digest is funny. And
A lot of people who grew up to work on comics had their comics confiscated by parents when they were young. Since your father was a humorist himself, did you not ever have that problem?
We had almost the reverse problem. We were forced to look at Playboy when we were a kid because our father was in, had stories in there all the time. And we had a housekeeper once who used to caught me with a bunch with Playboy, and she grabbed it away from me, and she said, "How dare you? I'm telling your father." And I said, "But my dad's in it." So there was really no way we could get punished for that. Mad Magazine was our favorite childhood magazine. It would be taken away in school and ripped up, but not at home.
And our dad worked at the company that did Marvel Comics in the early 60s.
They had a little office over in the corner at this place called Magazine Management where he edited some men's magazines where they gave a little corner to a guy named Stan Lee who created Marvels there. So I used to get number one of everything when I was 6 years old. I didn't know what they were, and I threw them out.
He'd bring home piles of comic books from the office every day, so it was really forced down our throats.
Freshly minted Marvel comics, but we never liked Marvel at all.
Why not?
The superhero stuff, even then, we knew was, you know, just kind of stupid. Grown men flying around in their underwear, just, it's just kind of pathetic.
I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having us in. Really appreciate it.
Drew and Josh Allen Friedman. Their new book of cartoons is called Warts and All. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A story tonight from Oakland, California. Police there admit now that hundreds of its rape case files have been closed prematurely and perhaps unfairly. We have letters from listeners tonight, mostly about the recent NPR series entitled The Prejudice Puzzle, a report on how the downturn in the national economy is affecting the northeastern states of the country. Senator John Kerry talks with NPR's Linda Wertheimer about serious doubts that he has, questions about the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. And also, I'll be talking with a singer-songwriter with guitar, Cheryl Wheeler, especially about her tune entitled Estate Sale.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Martin Scorsese's new movie, Goodfellas, opens this weekend. It's based on Nicholas Pileggi's book, Wise Guy, which is the as-told-to memoir of former mobster turned state witness Henry Hill. Pileggi and Scorsese wrote the screenplay. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
What's most amazing about Martin Scorsese's altogether amazing new movie is its intimacy. Right from the beginning of Goodfellas, Scorsese makes you feel as though he's putting his arm around you and murmuring in your ear.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
That's the movie's hero, Henry Hill. And Scorsese is quick to show us why he says that. Because gangsters are cool and powerful. Because they're treated like celebrities everywhere they go. And most of all, because they belong. For Henry, gang life begins in his teen years, when he starts running nefarious errands for Paulie, the mafioso across the street. When young Henry gets pinched, that's arrested. He thinks his superiors will be mad at him. Instead, they treat the whole event like a bar mitzvah, replete with fatherly advice from Henry's mentor, Jimmy, gorgeously played by Robert De Niro.
Congratulations. Here's your graduation present.
Listen, what for? I got pinched.
Everybody gets pinched, but you did it right. You told them nothing, and they got nothing.
I thought you'd be mad.
Man, I'm not mad. I'm proud of you. You took your first pinch like a man, and you learned the two greatest things in life.
What?
Look at me. Never rat on your friends, and always keep your mouth shut.
That's Christopher Cerrone as young Henry, and he's soon replaced by steely-eyed Ray Liotta as Henry the grown-up. Now Henry teams up with De Niro's Jimmy and Joe Pesci's psychopathic Tommy. Together, they become the three musketeers of the mafia fringe. Henry marries a nice Jewish girl, played by Lorraine Bracco. You might not believe she's Jewish, but she does everything else superbly. and soon enough the movie settles into a portrait of mob life that's at once more hilarious and more convincing than any gangster movie you've ever seen. A lot of critics have given Goodfellas a kind of B-plus rating. They can't help loving it. It's too much fun not to. But they complain that it doesn't have the usual dramatic arc, that it doesn't get deep into Henry Hill to explore the crises of conscience his criminality might arouse, or the moral decisions he has to make. Well, they're right. Goodfellas doesn't work the way we've been trained to expect a big gangster movie to work, but this isn't The Godfather we're watching. It isn't a grand and tragic romance of evil. The subject of Goodfellas is the hideous and comical banality of evil. It's about how a day in the life of a wise guy like Henry might involve dealing some cocaine, arguing with your wife, hiding some guns, going shopping for dinner, and then worrying about the important stuff, like how to get rid of a corpse or how to make sure the meatballs hold together for tonight's spaghetti. In this world, the usual explorations of character and conscience would look all too movie-ish. Henry isn't a movie hero, he's John Q. Thug, out for the main chance, excited by life in the underworld, even when he's not crazy about how casually his pals tend to kill one another off. Goodfellas feels the way the real Henry Hill's life must have felt, fast and jaggy, superficial maybe, but never less than thrilling. And Scorsese's direction is thrilling, too. Who else at this late date in the history of film is still finding enthralling new ways to use freeze frames and zooms, voiceovers and jump cuts and soundtrack music? For my money, this is Scorsese's best film since Taxi Driver nearly a decade and a half ago. And certainly, so far, the best movie of the year.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Bob Alls. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Spalding Gray performs an excerpt of his new monologue, Monster in a Box. And we talk with actor Jeff Goldblum, the star of The Fly and The Big Chill. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.